This is Chumash, Sefer Shmos, Shir 3. Okay. We have the book. All right. Okay, we're on page 299. When Moses kills the Egyptian that is striking the Hebrew man. 13. Went out the next day, and behold, two Hebrew men were fighting. He said to the wicked one, now the strict translation is, why will you strike your fellow? He replied, who appointed you as a dignitary, a ruler, and a judge over us? Do you propose to, I don't know why they translate murder, in Hebrew it's just kill. Propose to kill me as you killed the Egyptian? Moses was frightened, and he thought, indeed the matter is known. Pharaoh heard about the matter and sought to kill Moses. Yeah, see, now here, it's the same verb in Hebrew, la'rog, and now they translate it as kill, not murder. It's arbitrary. So Moses fled from before Pharaoh and settled in the land of Midian and sat by the well. Okay, now let's take a look at this incident, piece by piece. He saw two Hebrew men fighting. Okay, there too the translation is not really good. Nitzim. Let me see how Rashi takes Nitzim. I don't know, because of what I want to say in a moment, I just want to make sure that it's not contradicted here. Yeah. Rashi says Merivim. Arguing. Opposed to one another. Now Moses says to one, to the wicked one, why will you strike your fellow? What is worthy of note in that phraseology?
Will.
Yeah. He hasn't hit him yet. Well, if he hasn't hit him yet, then why does Moses call him the wicked one? From here, Chazal derived that threatening to hit someone already qualifies a person as wicked. You don't have to actually hit. Raising a hand already qualifies a person as wicked. So, nitzim here doesn't mean that they've already come to blows. If they've already come to blows, then Moses wouldn't say, why will you hit? He'd say, why are you hitting, or why have you hit? Right? On the point of coming to blows. And one apparently has his hand up. So Moses identifies him as wicked. Now, look at the response that he gets. Who are you to tell us what to do? And you're going to kill us like you killed us, like you killed me, like you killed the Egyptian. All Moses did was ask a question. Why will you hit your fellow? So this is a very brazen response. A very brazen response. The person's not stopping to think. Doesn't bother giving an explanation. Even though he is, I suppose, in the position of a kind of prince of the palace. And he's a Jew who cares about other Jews. Doesn't matter. Now, I want to point out that if you read this minimally, you can see a progression here. In the first incident, Moses is protecting one of his own against an outsider, foreigner. All you could read in that incident is Moses favors his own and protects them against outside punishment. Here, Moses is addressing two of his own. Here, Moses is expressing internal standards. We're all Jews, and there's standards by which Jews have to behave. So, in terms of what Moses cares about, what he focuses on, where his values are centered, this takes you a step beyond the first incident. I'm not saying in the first incident Moses didn't have that. It's the next day, after all. I'm not saying he developed morally, but what the incident shows is a side of Moses that the first incident doesn't show. Okay? Now, when the incident with the killing of the Egyptian takes place, Moses is in his teens. It says, in 15, he fled from before Pharaoh and settled in the land of Midian. He sat by the well. This incident takes place something like 70 years later. The Torah is just skipping over about 70 years of his life. Because now he's going to marry Tzipora and have a child, and then go down to save the Jewish people when he's 80. So, you know, a lot is passed over in silence here. Which is common for what the Torah will do. Once you just register it, that a great deal of Moses' life is just skipped here. Okay, sat by the well. Now, the minister of Midian. Here the translation is correct. The Hebrew says Kohen. Don't be confused. Kohen does not mean priest. Kohen means official. Official of some kind. Okay. We've taken that word to mean the official of the type of a priest. But that's not because it's limited to that. Now, the minister of Midian had seven daughters. They came and drew water, filled the troughs with the water of their father's sheep. The shepherds came and drove them away. Moses got up and saved them and watered their sheep. Can you understand why Rashi in 16 says that when it says the minister of Midian, it's talking about history? He once was the minister of Midian, but he's no longer the minister of Midian. What's pushing Rashi to say that? Not obvious?
Well, does Rashi have a motivation for saying
that? I mean, in the verse. Motivation for Rashi is in the verse. It's got to be in the words of the verse.
Yeah. That he once was.
Rather than to take it plain that he is. Rashi says, no, don't make a mistake. It's not that he is. He was. Well, the minister's daughters come to the trough, and they fill it up with water, and the shepherds drive them away. If he's really a minister, I don't think they would do that. Maybe they would draw water for the sheep themselves. Indeed, one might ask, why are his daughters shepherds if he's a minister? Does he have to use his own daughters as shepherds? Okay, maybe that was the custom at the time. Maybe the girl shouldn't sit at home and do nothing. You know, he could get around that, but if the shepherds have a free hand in driving them away, it can't be that he's a minister of the state. So, this shows you that the Torah can use a term which is a term based on history, not based on the present reality. And also, we should ask, why bother calling him that? Why bother identifying him as that? Is that going to play some role in understanding how the story works? So let's see. Moses got up and saved them and watered the sheep. What does that reveal about Moses? Here he's a stranger. This isn't a matter of the standards of his group, the behavior of his brethren. He's a stranger in another land who, for all he knows, have their own rules. They have their own rules, their own reasons. Doesn't matter. These are disadvantaged people, the underdog. And Moses saves them. Which means there's a sense of a universal standard here of behavior. Now, we don't know how he saved them. Maybe he convinced the shepherds this wasn't a nice thing to do. Or maybe he overpowered them, or who knows what. But he didn't stand by and say, I'm in a foreign country, and I'm an individual, I'm different. Who am I to pass judgment? Who am I to interfere? Who am I to take a hand? No. Nope. He takes a hand. So, he saved them and he watered their sheep. They came to rule their father. He said, how could you come so quickly today? From which you deduce that trouble at the troughs was a normal thing. They always had trouble. They have had to fill the trough 3 or 4 times or wait until everybody else was finished. Today, unlike all the other days, they had an easy job. They did it. They watered the sheep and they came home. So he says, now, who's Reuel? That name is familiar to you? That's, of course, Yisro. Right? Here's an example where the text clearly uses several names for the same person. And that's very important because, first of all, when you see different names, you can't automatically conclude it's a different person. You have to know from the context what's said about him. And also, if the text uses different names for the same person, if the text will use different names for God, one shouldn't automatically assume that it's different gods, or that it's different authors writing about the same God because he used different names. This is a text where different names for the same bearer of the name is an accepted piece of style. Okay, so they replied, an Egyptian man saved us from the shepherds and even drew water for us and watered the sheep. Why do you think they say an Egyptian man? Moses isn't Egyptian.
Because he's wearing Egyptian clothes.
Yeah, I mean, he looked Egyptian, right? That's where he came from. That was his whole kit and so on and so on. And presumably in the 60 or so years in between, wherever he was, out of Egypt, that's the way he presented himself. Now, if Egypt is running a large and powerful empire, not a bad idea to look Egyptian. Right? People, you know, it's like having today an American passport. Any country in the world, you've got an American passport, they think twice. Because America will take care of its citizens, and you don't want to get on the wrong side of America. You know, all sorts of things can happen. Looking Egyptian wasn't a bad thing for a person who's traveling around. He said to his daughters, then where is he? Why did you leave the man? Summon him and let him eat bread. At least offer him hospitality. He's a stranger in town. Now, I'm not sure that this is a critique of the daughters. Maybe it's not up to the daughters to offer a strange man hospitality. But for Yisro, it's elementary, especially if he does you a favor, to why did they translate it that way? Second. Come on. Yeah. Okay. Moses, I don't know, they just, they desired. In Rashi, it's a little more like he agreed, he went along with it. Yisro offered him not only supper, but hospitality, and a kind of partnership, and Moses went along with it. Right? And then he gave his daughter Zipporah to Moses as a wife. Now, of course, this didn't all happen in 2 days. But maybe now we can understand why the Torah designated him as Kohen Midian. This is not just an average person. True, he needed help. because he's been removed from his position. But his position, he's a person who had a noble position. He had a position of authority. He had a position of influence and power. So you're not dealing with an average person. Then, of course, you'll have to understand, so if he had it, how did he lose it? Now here, the Midrash tells us that he checked every idol worship in the world, and he found them all wanting, and he turned his back on all of them. Well, if you weren't an idol worshiper, you couldn't represent the society. You know, you couldn't be a leader in the society. I don't think we've ever had a president who was an announced atheist, and maybe not even a senator or a representative who would come out in public and say, I'm an atheist. People don't want that kind of person representing them. Right? So here, if that's true, then you have a whole explanation. You know why they pushed him aside? You know why Moses was attracted to him? You know why Moses agreed to marry his daughter? Because he was different from everybody in a way that made Moses able to take up a regular, you know, permanent relationship with the man. She gave birth to a son named Gershom, which literally means Gershom, stranger there. For he said, I have been, or I am, a stranger in a foreign land. So, there's no weakening of Moses' identity. That's what we learn from this. How does he look at himself? An expatriate Egyptian, given up on the past 60 plus years later. No, I'm still a Jew. I'm a stranger in a foreign land. During these many days, it happened that the king of Egypt died. The children of Israel groaned because of the work, and they cried out. Their outcry because of the work went up to God. God heard their moaning, remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and Jacob. God saw the children of Israel, and God knew. Oh, there's a lot here. There's a lot here. This is going to take us a while to sort out. First of all, the king of Egypt died, and the children of Israel groaned because of the work and cried out. What possible connection could there be between those two events? They're working now for a long time. More than 60 years. And they're crying because of the work. Presumably they're crying the whole time. The king of Egypt died and they cried out because of the work. What's the connection? And here you see what Chazal said, that while the king was alive and they were working, they couldn't cry out. They had to pretend to be happy citizens, joyously working in the service of the kingdom. But when the king died, and all Egypt was crying because of the death of the king, then the Jews too could cry. They weren't crying because of the death of the king, but nobody could accuse them of being disloyal by crying. Everybody was crying. So then they could freely cry because of the labor. Okay? That's point number one. What we're doing now is connections. If a verse says A, B, C, there's got to be some relationship between them. Not just disconnected facts. Okay, now, their outcry because of the work went up to God. They're not crying because they're in exile. They're not crying because they don't have brilliant Torah Shirim to hear. They're not crying because of assimilation. They're crying because of the work. The other fact is which, if they were spiritually more sensitive, should have led them to cry. No, that doesn't concern them. God heard their moaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, with Jacob. Any connection between those ideas? He heard their moaning, and he remembered. Now, first of all, what does it mean when it says God remembered? Does it mean that in the interim he forgot? So anybody who has a theology on straight says, clearly not, God doesn't forget. But then how are we supposed to explain what it means when it says he remembered? Remembered, we ordinarily think of as opposed to forgetting or after forgetting. So let me teach you something very, very important. It's true about this word, and then by extension, it's true about many other words as well. If you look in the book of Esther, which we have helpfully in the back here, on page 1253, now, you know how the book starts. Ahasuerus has a party, and he orders the queen to make an appearance, and she says no, and he deposes the queen. Right? Chapter 2 starts, after these things, when the wrath of Ahasuerus subsided, he remembered Vashti, and what she had done, and what had been decreed against her. He remembered. Are we supposed to think here that in the interim he forgot? Where has Vashti been these past couple of weeks? You know, I haven't seen her around the palace for at least 2 weeks. Maybe she's on a shopping spree in Acapulco. Oh, yes! Totally slipped my mind. 3 months ago, the party. Right, we threw her out. That's probably not the pshat, right? What you learn from this is that the verb lizkor in Hebrew means to make a present decision on the basis of a past fact. To make a present decision on the basis of a past fact. Doesn't mean to recall something which temporarily I forgot. That's not what it means. And especially when it's used vis-a-vis God, that's what it means. Doesn't mean he forgot in between or was in danger of forgetting in between, but it means he's using the past fact as the basis of a present decision. And when it says God saw, and when it says God knew, all these things are not that he came to do something new or he saw because he might not have seen. They're all verbs of resolving to act. Okay, that helps a little bit over here, but it doesn't finish it up. He heard their moaning and he remembered. Because he heard their moaning, he said, now is the time to act on the basis of the covenant I made to the patriarchs. What does that mean? The motivation for taking the Jews out of Egypt is that God promised the patriarchs. He promised them that their descendants would be taken out of Egypt and be brought to the land of Israel. Let's see how that promise could be fulfilled. What that promise commits us to. You know, I assume you know, that in the 3 days of darkness, 80% of the Jews died. So says the Midrash. What happened to God's promise to the patriarchs? God's promise to the patriarchs didn't save them. Further, after the golden calf, God says to Moses, I'll wipe them out. I'll wipe them all out. You'll object to me. My promise to the patriarchs, I'll make you into a new nation. You and your family, you'll become a new nation. Okay, it'll take a couple of hundred years. So what? I have time. Same thing with the spies. You have the sin of the spies. God says to Moses, I'll wipe them all out. And I'll make a new nation out of you. What are we seeing here? That the promise to the patriarchs doesn't necessarily protect any particular Jew, And it doesn't necessarily protect any particular population of Jews. There's always the possibility that it'll work out some other way. So, when we say God took the Jews out of Egypt because He promised Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, we have to understand that the promise is part of the picture. It's a necessary part of the picture, but it isn't the whole picture. It isn't the whole picture. Something has to be done to make this population relevant to that promise. To make them the representatives of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, so that when God says, listen, I promised Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and these people represent Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, so because of the promise to the patriarchs, I'm going to save this population. Some connection has to be made. What I'm telling you now is a statement of the Gaon of Vilna, which is printed in a Haggadah with his commentary. So says the Gaon of Vilna, it works like this. Here you have these Jews in Egypt. Will God save them? Only if they're connected. What's going to make them connected? If they pray to God. If they cry out to God. But they're not crying out to God. So God engineers that the oppression should become so bitter, so intense, that they can't help but cry out to God. Once they cry out to God, they're connected, and then they can be the subject to whom the promise applies. Because without that, the mere fact that He promised Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob that their descendants would be saved and come into the land of Egypt doesn't have to apply to this group. And that's what's hidden here in this verse, a little bit of what's hidden. God heard their moaning, and God remembered His covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. It means He can act on that covenant now with respect to them because they cried out to Him.
And yet it's from this group that the 80%...
And right, and even so, 80% didn't make it. So the process is initiated with them. And there will be a challenge for them to rise to understanding and appreciating the process. And there'll be enough of them to justify carrying out the process with them, even though, in this case, 80% didn't make it. Okay? This is a little bit of what's hidden in those two verses. Now, after all that, 25 is very strange. God saw the children of Israel, and God knew. So this has to mean something else. Rashi here gives a hint. He says God focused on them, His heart, and didn't hide His eyes from them. Focused on them, His heart, and didn't hide His eyes. Now, this combination of heart and eyes occurs in other places as well. If you look back to page 269, the beginning of Parshas Vayechi. Parshas Vayechi begins in a way that's different from all other Parshios. Do you know how? It's in the middle of a block of text. There's no break from the previous parsha. In all other cases, when the Torah is divided into paragraphs, into blocks of text, always a parsha begins at the beginning of a block of text. Here it begins in the middle of a block of text. And Rashi, quoting Chazal, say that's because, it's, in other words, it's blocked up. It's not set apart. It's not clearly visible. And he quotes a Chazal that when Jacob died, which is what this parsha is about, the eyes and the hearts of the Jewish people were stopped up. Blocked. There you have again, eyes and hearts. And then, in the previous page where we are, in 299, when it says that Moses went out to empathize with his brethren's burdens, Rashi says he focused his eyes and his heart on them to empathize with them. So, eyes and heart form a pair if they're blocked, then a person's fundamental sensitivity, perception, evaluation is blocked. If you want to connect to another person totally, then you have to use both your eyes and your heart. And when God sets himself to save the Jewish people, says Rashi, that's what the verse is indicating. When it says he saw and he knew, it means that his eyes and his heart were involved. This is a level of identification. In other words, when God saves the Jewish people, where does it come from? What kind of connection is it? What kind of interaction is it? Like we're going to see in a few minutes, we'll talk about the burning bush. And here, the Torah is describing it as an act of identification. It's not just God viewing from afar, noting the objective circumstances, and gosh, I made a promise to the patriarchs, maybe the time has come to pay the promise, so it's time to start manipulating things to pay off my debts. But God is pictured here as being personally involved, personally identified with what's going on. Right? That's the quality of the action that's going to take place. So, for example, when he says to Moses, and through Moses to Pharaoh, the Jewish people are my firstborn. You're playing with fire here. You're interfering with the relationship between a father and his firstborn. That's not just, I'm the creator of the universe, this is my tachnit, you know, this is my plan. Don't get in my way. That bespeaks a much closer, involved relationship with the events that are going on. And that's part of, anyway, what's indicated in 25. The battery looks like it's on its way out. Anyway, but it's recording. All right. Let's go on. Moses was shepherding the sheep of Jethro, his father-in-law, priest of Midian. Now here, first of all, you got Jethro. Before you had Reuel, now you have Jethro, which means he has, as the person has two names. They translate priest here, which is absolutely unjustified. They translate the same word Kohen before as minister. They translated minister here too. Didn't become a priest in between. Anyway, he guided the sheep far into the wilderness, arrived at the mountain of God towards Horeb. An angel of Hashem appeared to him in a blaze of fire from amid the bush. He saw, and behold, the bush was burning in the fire, but the bush was not consumed. Moses thought, I will turn aside now and look at this great sight. Why will the bush not be burned? Hashem saw that he turned aside to see, and Hashem called out to him from amidst the bush. Okay. A couple of little things. Is the bush burning or not?
Yes.
was burning.
Right. And what does it say in 3? But in the Hebrew, it's the same word, right? It's the same verb. And before, can you use the word for consumed? There's a different verb. And now it switches to burned. So there's something going on with the words here, which I haven't figured out. Why it doesn't say, when it describes his vision, it says he saw the snake and ukal. It's not eaten up. When he speaks, he changes the verb. Doesn't use the verb that expresses his experience. He uses a different verb. I don't know why that is. I'm just pointing it out. Now, given what we said 17 minutes ago, what does 4 say? Hashem saw that he turned aside to see, and God called out to him from the midst of the bush. How do you read those two together? When it says he saw that he turned aside to see, and he called out, it means God's observing Moses' action is the reason why he calls out to him. He observed him turning aside to examine the bush, and he called out. Of course he observed it. God knows everything. God sees everything. So the text is telling you, that's why he spoke to Moses. Because he took note of the fact that Moses turned aside to see the burning bush. The Malbim raises two fundamental questions here. First of all, that's a reason to talk to Moses? Who wouldn't? There's this flaming bush and nothing's being consumed. Wouldn't you take a look? Wouldn't anybody take a look? How could that be the reason? Oh, I'm waiting to see what Moses' reaction will be. And if he turns aside, then I'll talk to him. And if he strolls on further, then I won't talk to him. It's ridiculous. Furthermore, points out the Malbim, the verb here is very peculiar. The verb here is turned aside to look. Is Moses turning away from or turning towards? When you turn, you could be doing either or both. In Hebrew, lasur means to turn away from. Vayifem would mean, and he turned to. Here it's lasur. You have to imagine Moses standing on the path. Over there is a burning bush, and he turns to investigate. Would you write, turns away from or turns towards?
Turns to God, so he probably had like a backtrack for a second.
That it doesn't say here. So he turns to see. I would write he turned towards. What am I turning away from? What's he turning away from? He's drawn by the bush, so he turns towards the bush. Says the Malbim, but the verb is to turn away from. So the Torah is hinting to us something here. Now, I'm going to put the Malbim's point in modern terminology, but this is the point. Yes, everyone in the world would be attracted and would want to investigate. How would each person see it? How would he interpret it? Let's imagine a physicist. There's a fire going on over here, and nothing's being burned up. That's very peculiar. Fire is oxidation. Oxidation means it's got to be fuel being used up. This requires an investigation. Maybe I'll get a government grant, you know, and discover a new physical phenomenon. Or imagine an entrepreneur. Free energy. Let's hook up a power plant and sell the energy. You know, we can make a mint. Or the tourism minister. Oh, we can make a mint off this. Just tell people. Here's a prodigy that no one else has ever seen. Or a painter. How would you paint a picture to make it clear to the person looking at the picture that the flames are not consuming the material of the bush? Every person will approach it in a different way, depending upon his orientation. Moses' orientation was to turn away. Says the Malbim, he turned away from all physical associations because he said this is a ruchni, this is a spiritual event. This can only be approached from a spiritual point of view. All other things have to be abandoned. essentially for Moses, it was a turning away from. God observed that. He said, that's the way Moses took it. He took it as something which has to be approached ruchni, spiritually. So then I'm going to talk to him about it. There will be a spiritual interaction here. Now, the Malbim's questions are absolutely iron. You have to answer them. I don't know how to prove from the verse that the turning away is a turning away from the physical, except that it justifies the fact that Moses, that God spoke to him. But at least it makes sense out of the passage. Okay, one more comment and we'll be enough for today. He called to him, Moses, Moses, and he replied, here I am. And he said, do not come any closer to here. Remove your shoes from your feet, for the place upon which you stand is holy ground. Where is it holy? When he says, don't come any closer to here, the natural thought is, here must be very holy. So much so that Moses can't come any closer. That's probably correct. Then he says to him, take off your shoes where you are. Because where you're standing is holy ground. So there are two gradations here. Don't come any closer, but don't, you don't have to go any further away. You can be where you are. But even where you are, there is a measure of holiness, and that requires you to take off your shoes. So there's a double thing going on. There are gradations of holiness, and the difference between where you are, where you can stand but must take off your shoes, and places which are too high where you can't go. And they're both in this world. They're both in this world. A little bit maybe like the temple, where you have the area that's called holy, where the priests go and they take care of their services and everything else. But when they do the service, they do it without shoes. You have to take off your shoes to do the service. And then there's the Holy of Holies, where under normal conditions, nobody can go. Even with your shoes off. And only once a year, on Yom Kippur, the high priest, a special time, can go in to the Holy of Holies. Right? So here you already have a structurally identical setup. The bush is like the Holy of Holies. Can't go there at all. And where you're standing, where you can stand, you have to take off your shoes. Okay?